Last year, I had the opportunity to list my Montecito guest house on Airbnb. This was part of a special project that Airbnb spearheaded to build connection and to make the world feel a little less lonely. It was such a pleasure to get to know my Airbnb guests over dinner and share my home with them so that they could rest and recharge on their trip. But typically, the beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Being a host on Airbnb is great for those who travel frequently, have extra space, or own a seasonal home. If you've stayed at an Airbnb, you know the unique experience it offers. And now you can share that same experience with others in addition to earning additional income on the side. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
When you are pioneering anything or introducing new ideas to the culture,
you get criticized.
You do?
Yeah. Did you hear about that?
I didn't find the one. I found someone I respected and we made it the one.
In a sort of longing kind of view of love, people understand each other as if by magic.
Nothing in itself is addictive on the one hand. On the other hand, everything could be addictive if there's an emptiness in that person that needs to be filled.
I now know that nobody changes until they change their energy. And when you change your energy, you change your life.
I'm Gwyneth Paltrow. This is the Goop Podcast, bringing together thought leaders, culture changers, creatives, founders and CEOs, scientists, doctors, healers and seekers, here to start conversations. Because simply asking questions and listening has the power to change the way we see the world. Here we go. My guest today is Edwina von Gaal. Edwina is an incredible landscape designer based in East Hampton, New York. She is also the founder of the Perfect Earth Project, a nonprofit organization dedicated to raising the consciousness around toxin-free lawns and landscapes. We had a fascinating conversation about the environmental impact of our landscape designs and what we can do to take care of the ecosystems that we often overlook in our own backyard. Edwina explains that the best garden is one that is given permission to grow and age gracefully, which I find is a beautiful metaphor for life. Let's get to my chat with Edwina.
So will you take me back to your love of horticulture and plants and how it started? Was it a hobby that you then started to parlay into something more serious?
Well, I think it started when I was born in a way, because my grandmother was very into gardening and she had a big garden. And then my mom was president of the local garden club and my dad grew vegetables and I did time in the garden. You know, that was just expected of you then. And now it's amazing to me how valuable that was, because once I handed a client a pack of sunflower seeds because we just put the garden in for her. We did a vegetable garden as part of her main garden. So I handed her a pack of sunflower seeds and I said, I saved this for you to plant yourself with your kids. And she looked at it with horror. And she said, no, I have no idea how to plant a seed. It just never occurred to me that someone would not know how to plant a seed.
It's a little bit intimidating, right? So many of us in America and across the world are so far removed from the process of cultivating our own food or our own plants. I mean, I remember in maybe the second grade doing the art, you know, the science project where you're sprouting, you know, a tomato plant or something like that. But it is intimidating. I mean, we've gotten really far removed from that. And do you know when that started to happen in our culture?
Sort of incrementally, but I think that it probably started post-Second World War as people's lives became more consumed by things other than home. But then it came back to home because people are consumed by their homes, but it's not quite the same way. And so it became more and more about product, I think, over time. And that's really what replaced the garden. And as fewer and fewer people did their own gardening, so just like kids don't do chores anymore, it's all tied together with that. People have become increasingly distanced. And I think part of it too is the tools that we have been given that are increasingly sophisticated, so that both the mechanical and chemical tools at our disposal to do these jobs for us, they distance us as well. And you know, after DDT was banned, everybody thought, oh, well, this new stuff is safe. And of course, we're coming to find it's not. But still, we depend on them to keep us at a distance, because nature's becoming more and more scary for people as they distance themselves. So it's sort of this feedback loop of the farther I am from it, the less I understand it, the more it scares at me, the more I'll distance myself from it.
One of the things that intrigues me so much about you is you have done some incredibly famous gardens. You've worked with Frank Gehry and Annabelle Seldorf and Calvin Klein and all these fabulous people, because aesthetically, I imagine they're responding to your beautiful designs. And you actually see things, you know, from my point of view, anyway, quite differently, right? Like your ideal execution of a garden is not sort of this American super tidy green lawn. And so there's been this beautiful convergence that you've accomplished of being this incredibly chic, sought after landscape expert, but then you're making this incredible movement back to planting native plants, natural plants, cultivating the species coming back. So I would love to hear about how you approach a project. What are the pillars that you are assessing? And then how do you begin the design process?
Well, it's always evolving, which is fun. But for me, part of what makes a garden maybe speak to people in a way that I can do that, I can bring nature into the conversation, is that, yeah, it's a conversation. And once again, it's like going back to that word product. It is not a product. It is a process. I do not deliver a done landscape, because that would mean it would have to be stuck like that forever. And there's as Isaac Mizrahi says, oh, you mean like a facelift, that like the older you get and the more you're trying to look the same and the weirder it gets, because you're not letting this thing age gracefully. You know, a landscape should be given permission to age and to grow. I mean, we'll never see it beyond its infancy anyway. But so many landscapes, people expect their landscape to look exactly the same every time they step on the property. And that's why they can't tolerate a leaf or a blade of grass or anything, that because the landscape is designed for that kind of static. And my landscapes are designed to never be the same. They're just never the same. And you know, the light changes. So like light is such an important part of landscape. So I think that that's kind of where that extra conversation comes in, that the artists and architects that I've worked with respond to, because there's subtext. You know, the garden is talking, and I see it like, so you get a project, and a project is always started because of an architectural moment, right? Very few people wake up and say, I think I'll just completely like do a landscape and I'll hire somebody to come and do it. No, they're doing a renovation, or they bought a new house, or they're building a house. And so I get come in and there's a team involved. But generally that means there's an architect and there's a place. Like you asked me like that, like the place is super important. So architects are not known for being without ego. And nature is an extremely strong force. So my job is to basically disappear between those, because my feeling is that if you bring another voice, another strong like voice into this conversation, that garden can never feel peaceful, because it's caught between the architecture and the place, and it's kind of stuck there. And I just need to like step out of it and let the architecture and the place come together over this piece of land. So when you're looking out from the house, the windows and the views frame what you're seeing, but it goes right into the background of what you're seeing. And when you look back at the house, it works in the reverse, that it works in the context of the house or the building that you're working on. So it's a nice conversation one can always have with the architects and the other people on the site. But and back to that first question about like, was I ever a traditional gardener and designer? Absolutely. And there was a time, you know, when every new introduction from England and the Gertrude Jekyll border, that was it, you know, and I had to have it. And the harder to grow it, the better. And the more unhappy it was in your garden, the more you could say, I did it. And, you know, now I just want plants that want to be there and don't need me. And I don't want to saddle my clients, because we all ended up moving away from that English gardening style because we realized that that was like having a three-year-old outside your door forever. It's like, it was just never-ending need. That's not the way to garden, you know. So what my goal is now, and in terms of what we're teaching and how we're trying to have this kind of a dialogue with the landscape design world and clients is gardens that are designed for independence. Because, and I like to ask, like, when you design a garden, are you thinking about how many different trades and how many different actions are going to be required? How many different contracts is this client going to need to sign in order to keep this garden looking like you are intending?
What is the carbon count in maintaining this natural space? Right.
Exactly. So actually, that's something we're working on now, is trying to calculate what is the environmental cost of each component of garden management, and how can you reach neutral? How can you reach what is carbon neutral? Because if you take your grass clippings and bag them and remove them from the property, they go to the landfill where they produce methane. And methane is by umpteen times a more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon. And people are doing that. 20% of our landfills are what's classified as landscape waste, which isn't waste because it's the food your landscape made for itself. And if the lawn is properly mowed at the proper time, not when it's wet, and it's properly managed, so it's a living system, grass clippings disappear within a very short period of time. And they go back into the lawn and they feed the lawn. And if there are places where your clients say, oh, but I don't want grass clippings on my feet, then you say, well, where will you be walking within the few hours after we mow? And we'll rake those away, you know, that you won't see them. So there are all these processes that you can design into the process. If you're putting trees in that you know are going to outgrow a space and will need to be clipped, or if you're putting in shrubs that are intended to stay exactly as the size they were installed or in a shape, that's a constant care component. And so we're trying to look at how can gardens still meet the aesthetic, although we are trying to change the aesthetic of it. But, you know, how can gardens still be something that delights people, but also are highly ecosystem serviceable?
Last year, I had the opportunity to list my Montecito guest house on Airbnb. This was part of a special project that Airbnb spearheaded to build connection and to make the world feel a little less lonely. It was such a pleasure to get to know my Airbnb guests over dinner and share my home with them so that they could rest and recharge on their trip. But typically, the beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Being a host on Airbnb is great for those who travel frequently, have extra space, or own a seasonal home. If you've stayed at an Airbnb, you know the unique experience it offers. And now you can share that same experience with others in addition to earning additional income on the side. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
So what are we supposed to do with these lawns then? Do we need to change the paradigm of what a backyard looks like? Give me kind of the basics. What are the Edwina rules?
Okay, so in terms of lawn, I am not anti-lawn at all. Like, where are you going to play? But it's how much lawn and what are you putting on it? Because you do not want to be playing on a lawn that's toxic, and you don't have to. You can have just a wonderful play space lawn if you're working with someone who knows how to do it and they do it right.
Are most lawns toxic? So take a regular American lawn. Like, in your mind, how should we be caring for the lawn? Should we be planting wild grasses? What is the most optimal way to treat a lawn?
Well, there are lots of options. But first of all, we just say, how much lawn do you actually use? Like, think about the amount of your lawn that you actually play on and walk on and use. And that's the size of your lawn. So it's more like area rug as opposed to wall to wall. You want to look into yourself and say, well, why do I have this much lawn? And oftentimes, you know, this is like self-examination. Lawn is therapy. You know, am I doing this to impress people? Because I can, you know, and so forth. And then the other thing is like, and so that it's the size of the lawn and what's going on it. So are you putting chemicals on your lawn because you saw a dandelion there? That's a cycle of dependency, because if you kill dandelions, it opens up space for more weed seeds to come in. So the goal is that you have a minimum amount of lawn, that you mow it high. We say mow to 4, cut to 3 inches. Taller lawn is like a more relaxed hairstyle. If you're wearing a buzz cut, your head's going to get scorched.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what happens to your soil. Because when you cut grass really short, that's when it stands up just perfectly straight up like that. You know, so that's your buzz cut look. Like, it's standing straight up. And that started really after the Second World War, when the military thing was, the military saved us, you know, from being lost to the enemy. And everything military was, felt good, felt safe, protected. So everybody went for things that were very regimented and very uniform. And it was the same time that all those chemicals became available, because many of them were war surplus. But letting it grow longer, it gets a little floppier. It's more like casual today. Like, everything else has gone that direction. I'm not sure why lawns can't.
Agree.
And because it's that, first of all, you have more leaf surface, which means more photosynthetic surface, which means more energy going into the roots.
All right.
So it's healthier. It also protects the crown. Each leaf, each grass is a little plant. You know, there's thousands and thousands of little plants out there. And if their crown is exposed to the sun or exposed more, a longer blade protects it. It's like a little, you know, it also shades the soil so it doesn't dry out as quickly. And it also protects it from weed seeds coming in. So if you have a lot of weeds in your lawn, it means not so much that the weeds are bad. It means your lawn isn't as healthy as it could be. And the more you stress your lawn by cutting it short and opening it to sun and reducing leaf surface, the more likely it will be to succumb to not only weed infestation, but fungus and bacterial diseases. And then when you add to that the way people water, which is the third component, when you leave your grass clippings and mow high and water properly, which means water seldom and water deep. Most people, if they have an irrigation system, the irrigation person comes in the spring, turns it on, sets it for every other day, 20 minutes a day, and leaves. And that's the same for the entire time it's on. And there's nothing else that's the same during that time. You know, there's sun, there's shade, there's heat, there's rain. And none of that is taken into account. And basically what it does is it wets the top of the soil, but it doesn't get down deep. And so what's happening is that top section, the crowns, never dry out. So, and that's what people think is good. Like, oh, my grass will be thirsty. But compare it instead to spending your entire summer in wet socks. Your feet are going to be nasty. The grass needs to dry out. But what happens is that frequent short-term watering but it's all the water's like in this much of the soil. So the roots never go down here because that part gets dry. So then you have short roots. And so if you do stop watering, yeah, your grass dries out because it only has what, you know, it's only this much to draw on. So basically you don't water unless you absolutely have to, which means generally in the Northeast, not starting until like mid-June, late June, when it gets really hot. And unless you have a really, really dry season, you probably shouldn't need to water more than once a week. And when you water really deep.
So what does that mean? How long do you turn the sprinklers on?
Well, that depends, of course, on your soil and your slopes and your everything, but generally about an hour. And if you have a big slope in the grass and it's all running off, then you might want to split it into two days or two moments, like a half an hour, let it soak in, and then do another half hour. And my favorite tool is my moisture gauge. And I have this thing that's like little box on a long probe, and you stick it in the ground and it tells you wet or dry.
It does make sense when you think about, especially I'm just thinking about where you are, where we have a house out on Long Island. You think about these massive summer storms that roll through and it rains and rains and rains, and then it's dry for weeks at a time. And that's in nature. That's how nature waters everything, right? It's not 20 minutes a day every day. I mean, that's probably true for somewhere like Hawaii, right? Where it rains for 20 minutes a day, but completely different set of plants and vegetation.
Yes. Yes. You put your finger on it. That's exactly what we say to people. Think like nature.
Right.
Replicate nature as an ideal. So nature doesn't tend to deliver the right amount of water once a week. So that's where you come in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because grass is not really a natural system. It's generally somewhat of a monoculture, and you are stressing it with mowing. And so other people say, well, I don't water at all. That's an option, but it will stress your lawn. And when you stress it, it will take a while to recover. So I do recommend that judicious watering is necessary to have a lawn you love.
Let's take a quick break to talk about one of our partners.
From visionary filmmaker Luca Guadagnino comes a new movie called Challengers, starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Feist. Zendaya plays Tashi Duncan, a former tennis prodigy turned coach who transforms her husband, Art, into a world-famous Grand Slam champion. To jolt her husband out of his recent losing streak, she makes him play a challenger event, close to the lowest level of the pro tournament. Her strategy takes a turn when Art finds himself standing across a net from his former best friend and Tashi's former boyfriend, Patrick. Tensions run high as past and present collide. Tashi must ask herself, what will it cost to win? See Challengers only in theaters April 26. Get tickets now at challengersmovie.com.
Okay, let's get back to the conversation. So for those of us trying to imagine, okay, we use as much lawn as an area rug, then if there's more lawn left, what happens there?
One more thing about lawns.
Okay.
You got to learn to love clover.
I do love clover.
Yeah, and my grandson said, oh, hey, look, the word love is in the middle of the word clover.
Oh.
And he's right.
He's right.
Yeah. Just because clover is nitrogen fixing and it has a wonderful symbiotic relationship with turf grasses. And so, and it's very heat tolerant, and turf grasses are naturally not. So it makes your lawn look greener.
That's what you're supposed to have, right? A mix.
Yeah.
It's not only these shoots of lawn grass, right? We're supposed to have a mix.
That's the classic English lawn. And people always think that they're like English lawn is our idea of lawn, but English lawn is actually, if you look at it closely, it's a very complex mixture of little wildflowers and grasses and things. And people are, you know, appalled to think that that would be a lawn, but we're hoping that it catches on a bit, you know, but at least clover, it would be a nice thing too. And really our concern with clover is really, it was It's marketing. When they introduced the chemicals that kill broadleaves, which was to kill the dandelions, because dandelions are for some reason vilified, they actually do good things for lawns, but I won't try to change people that dramatically. But when they introduced the broadleaf killer chemicals, they realized it was killing clover, and clover had always been included in grass seed mixes because it does make a healthier, denser, greener lawn. And then they said, oh, well, we'll just make clover bad, and then we can sell more fertilizer because clover provided the necessary nitrogen to lawns. So there's that. So, okay, so now you've decided to reduce your lawn and you've got some space. You fill it with native plants and you have a lot of options. So that could be native grasses, native ground covers, and generally the high functioning ecosystem garden has four layers. So you have the tree layer, and then you have a shrub layer, and then you have a herbaceous perennial plant layer, and then you have ground cover layer. And so if you want to really get into the weeds, so to speak, with it, that's what you do. You know, you build that, and that's where birds will be happy and butterflies will be happy. And you keep some areas with more sun and some with less, because most of the pollinator flowers like a lot of sun because they're meadow plants. And so that's where you could start. So I usually say, since your lawn was probably sunny, but you could start taking away lawn in the areas where it never really was happy anyway. That's a good place to start, because why keep forcing it to be something it just can't? And so then you have to look at that space for, well, what would want to be here? It might be moss, or which, like, once you get into it, it's not that easy to grow. It's hard to get rid of and it's hard to grow. But there are a lot of wonderful native ground covers that are really beautiful and do well under trees, do well mingled with roots. And
this is something that people can Google based on where they are, right? Mm-hmm. Just look up, grass is native to me, et cetera.
Yes, there's a couple of websites that have now come out that I recommend, which is, one is the Audubon Plant Database. It's not super extensive, but it's really good because it's zip code based.
Great.
It's beautiful. It tells you the birds that those plants will attract. And it really sticks with plants that are pretty much definitely going to grow for you.
Right.
And so that I really like. It doesn't get off into the rare or amazingly unique, but that's just what the average person needs, and that's there. The other one is the Xerces Society, X-E-R-C-E-S. They're the insect people. They focus on what insects their plants will attract. So, you know, the bees and the butterflies and stuff. Those are my two, like, nationwide favorites go to. The Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center in Texas has an amazing database where you can look up plants if you've heard the name of something that you'd like to know more about. It's just wildflower.org. And Pollinator Pathways, pollinator-pathways.org, or you can Google Pollinator Pathway Northeast, although they're getting to be quite national. They're starting to put up really great informational PDFs, downloads, a lot of information. And so if you want to create a pollinator garden, that's often the sort of, we call it the garden gateway drug. They're the starter. Once you put in a plant and you see the butterflies just flocking around it, it's hard to stop.
Yeah.
So, but I like shrubs too.
You like. So are these the kind of steps, if someone wants to transition to an all natural yard maintenance, is it identifying plants? Is it identifying, okay, this will be the watering schedule? How can people start to take steps to do this regenerative kind of landscaping?
First of all, you can get to know your ecoregion. So there used to be the USDA zone maps that told you where your hardiness, but now they're ecoregions. So you can then look up different things about, these are the plants that actually evolved. And the Audubon does that too. These are the plants that evolved in your area. So other than lawn, if you plant plants that are exactly right for your place, so even within those, you have to think about, well, is my soil all sand or is it all clay? That'll have some influence on what you plant. You really shouldn't have to water. You water stuff in when you plant it. If it's a big tree or a shrub, you probably should give it some supplemental water for the first year or two. But the idea is after that, it does not need you.
And then think of the cost savings. I mean, my goodness.
Yes. And see, that goes back to like, how many different services did you hire to take care of your landscape last year? You know, and it's like another part of this tidiness thing, because that's my other like big nemesis, ticks and tidiness.
Ticks and tidiness.
they're killing me. But because like people are, and it's this fear, it's this separation from nature thing that people have decided that, you know, they know what an interior looks like. They can totally relate to the interior of their home and they know how to talk to their cleaning staff. So they use the same language for their landscape. So like blow that, so blowers are like the outdoor equivalent of a vacuum.
Yeah.
It's just the only language they have for relating to their landscape staff. And so now our landscapes have become tidy. So they see a dead twig in a tree and they say, oh, take that out. But fact is, that is an ecosystem. That's an endangered, it's a micro endangered ecosystem is dead wood that is actually in a tree or a shrub because there are insects that will only live there. And it is a bird feeder.
So you assess a system that's there depending on climate, location.
Soil, wind, yeah. And then you pick the plants that you know are going to be happy there. And so, yeah, your garden may look the same as another one down the street, but they do anyway, the way they're designing them now, you know.
It's true.
There's a row of hydrangeas, there's a couple of boxwoods, and there's a crepe myrtle tree. And so wouldn't it be nicer if they were all the same, but instead they were some, you know, native viburnums that are covered with berries that the birds really love. And the plants that are native, they've evolved together. So they actually, in this amazing magic of nature, they deliver fruits that have the right amount of fat and sugar content balanced for the time of year that the birds need them.
Amazing.
Yeah. So going into the winter, the berries have more fat content, the ones that ripen then, because the birds need it to get through the winter. But in the spring, they tend to be more sugar, and because they're doing a lot of flying. And feeding. And that's where all the caterpillars are out. If you, it just like amazes me that like if people see caterpillars on a tree, they call the tree guy and they kill him, right? Because that caterpillar is eating my tree. But maybe the week before they hired someone to come and whack a third of the leaves off that tree. So like, wait a minute. You can't give those leaves to the caterpillar to raise enough little chickadee babies to keep a stable chickadee population on your property. That chickadee needs maybe 20,000 caterpillars in a season. And so, and you're not going to share a few leaves with them. I mean, you weren't going to eat those leaves, you know, so why not? Like, but great news. People are now getting it because they're planting milkweed. And when they see a monarch caterpillar on a milkweed, everybody feels like they've really done it. So I'm just suggesting that they could extend that generosity to a large population of caterpillars, much broader.
We're inclusive of all caterpillars.
Exactly.
Let's take a quick break to talk about one of our partners.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Acer bag collection in its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Acer is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and the 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Acer collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
Okay, let's get back to the conversation.
So this is a good segue for me to ask you about your two-thirds for the birds campaign, which you were telling me about when I saw you last.
It is a good segue. Thank you.
Because you told me that the North American bird population has been declining dramatically. What is two-thirds for the birds? And then what are your goals for it?
Two-thirds for the birds is about the bird decline, or it was inspired by the bird decline. Some news came out in 2017 about the fact that North America has lost a third of its bird population since the 70s. So that amounts to about 3 billion birds. And that's in overall populations. And the interesting thing about it is that actually, it's not like the fragile bird populations or the rare and odd ones. It's the common everyday birds. And the two major drivers of the decline were determined to be loss of habitat and use of pesticides. And so where is that happening? That's happening where we live, because we're taking over the places where our familiar common birds live, and we're depriving them of habitat. So it's a pretty direct, and we're removing, so our landscapes have become food deserts, basically, because not only are they cleaned and cleared and clipped, they're largely planted with plants that are sold as the ones that nothing will eat. So what does that tell you? And then on top of that, they get sprayed a lot with pesticides. So there's still birds out there, but there are far fewer. And there's a whole psychological process that we reset our standards, so to speak, on a regular basis. So we think we're seeing the same amount of birds that we used to see, but actually we're not. That's where the research comes in handy. So at the same time I was reading this devastating news about the bird crash, Doug Tallamy, who is an incredible crusader for bird insect populations, he's an entomologist and wrote this seminal book on backyard habitat. Well, he had a new book coming out. And so he let me read the manuscript, and it was like this giant joy bolt hit me, because he had been able to actually quantify what a bird population-friendly landscape contains. And that was 70% native plants and wow, no pesticides. So then I could stop just being so vague and saying, well, native plants are good, you ought to have some, to being quite specific and setting goals for people.
Yeah.
So 70% is good, but I thought, well, it's sort of two-thirds, and two-thirds rhymes with birds, so that's even better. So if you have two-thirds native plants in your yard and you do not use pesticides, then you're contributing to the positive and you're aiding the return of the bird population. Mm. Less than that, unfortunately, you're contributing to the decline. And so that's, to me, a very big decision that everybody should be aware of. And I'm really raising the initial challenge to those of us who are professionals, that we would never even dream of designing another landscape that didn't meet that pretty simple criteria. How could you know that you were actually contributing to the loss of biodiversity? Because birds are really, they're the indicator species. It's not just the birds, it's everything. So I started two-thirds for the birds, and it's 234birds.org, and it's a website, and it's a movement. It's completely non-commercial. There is no donate button anywhere. There are no petitions to sign. It's really from your heart. And it was just a list. You can sign up for our list, and that means you've joined the community. And you can look at other people who are in the community. If they've chosen to share their email with you, you can talk to each other. You can hopefully find a landscape designer who was in your neighborhood who's also decided to join the community. We have a massive toolbox. It's in homage of the Whole Earth Catalog. It's called Access to Tools, and it keeps growing. And basically, it's as simple as that, that we hope that people will contact each other in their communities and that they'll keep signing up so they can find each other and share resources. And they're always welcome to write to us if they have questions about it. But all of those websites and databases and everything, they're in the toolbox.
Mm. That is so fantastic. And I think it takes a little bit of a loosening of a paradigm around what your lawn is supposed to look like. And also swallowing the pill that planting plants that aren't native and then spraying them are actually really bad for the earth. And I don't think we think about that in that way, you know? I mean, of course, if we're spraying weed killers, we know that's not great. But, you know, we just think, oh, hydrangeas are beautiful and all my neighbors have them. I don't know if that's native to Long Island or not.
Yeah, it's going to require a new kind of perception.
Mm-hmm.
I think of it as, when people say it looks, they can say it looks messy. I don't think it's messy at all. Nature is not really messy. Nature is highly complex. And the more you begin to read that complexity, the more you learn about it. I like to ask people if it's possible. Don't kill anything if you don't know its name.
Mm.
And so that changes everything. That includes weeds, because if you create a space that is intended to be a haven for the native species, but you then weed them out because you didn't recognize that maybe a rare and endangered something happened to seed in and you didn't know what it was and you just rip that. I mean, I'm sure I've done it, but it's an interesting new way. Rebecca McMacken, who runs the horticulture at the Brooklyn Bridge Park, she's really pioneered this concept with her staff, and it's wonderfully inspirational. And I'm hoping that all of the landscapers that I work with and that everybody works with, we can start to train them in recognizing both the insects and the plants that they're working with.
Do you feel like it's trending in that direction? Do you think people are becoming more aware and it's trending more positively?
You know, so like political trends and other trends, some of us are going one way and others are going the other way. And I'd like to think, though, that those who want to come in this direction, the pro-nature direction, there's more and more enthusiasm and more commitment and more buy-in and a whole lot more available to help them do it. And that's what I'm doing through the Perfect Earth Project and Two Thirds for the Birds, is giving people the tools they need to really make it and find it's joyful. You know, that's the other thing. It really makes you feel good. You are doing an absolutely undeniable positive environmental act, and it doesn't cost you anything. And it's in your own backyard. What it takes more of is you, like paying attention. But it's actually not more, because you're not pruning and clipping and fertilizing and spraying and doing all that other stuff. You're just engaging. You're getting to know what it is. You're looking at the complexity and you're seeing the order in it.
Mm. I got to get my shit together, Edwina.
Oh, good. It's not time. Over. Don't be overwhelmed. That's the one thing that don't be overwhelmed. It's a process. You know, it's forever. I will never know enough, ever, ever. It's long. You know, it's just that the smallest things reap big rewards.
Is there anything that is really dissonant to you in a garden? What are the things that really make you cringe?
I guess it's that whole thing of everything held in place, like a garden that I can see has nowhere to grow. You know, it's all clipped and it's all shaped, and you know that the only way that garden it has no future without suppression. It has to be suppressed. And the trouble is, as it grows, as the wood gets denser, let's say on a shrub, the cuts you're making are deeper. Every cut is a wound.
Mm.
when you prune. That's a wound. So if you're really cutting all around, you're doing really multiple wounds. The cuts are getting deeper and deeper and deeper as that plant matures. And when I see those kind of cuts, bad pruning just really hurts me.
Because you talk to the plants, don't you, Edwina? Or the plants talk to you.
They talk to me. Yeah, no, they don't want to hear from me. But they have a lot to tell. I have a lot to hear from them. Yeah,
they do. And just how do they talk? How do they talk to you?
I never thought before. You know, I always thought, no, you know. But then so many people have said to me through the years, well, how did you know that? And I have no answer. I don't know how I know it.
And oh, amazing.
It's just, but we all have different things like that we, you know, because it's not like I hear voices, you know, it's just like I'm inclined, you know, I'm just inclined to feel it, like to sense it, to and it's a lot of years of observation, a lot of time.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. Yeah. It's almost like poetry watching you stand in a garden. And
oh, thank you. And gardens are like, to me, it's like, they're a party. And because I know them all, you know, I'm there with my friends. And so whenever I go to a new place and I don't know the plants, I got to learn them because like, it's like, then I'm at this party and I don't know anybody there. And I feel so sorry for people whose gardens they're strangers to them. You know, they're in this thing and no wonder they're afraid of them. No wonder they fear letting them out of control because they don't know anything about them. Mm. And so as long as it never changes, they figure it's okay.
Are you at your happiest when you're in nature in that way?
When I go someplace, I get out of the city as fast as I can.
Thank you for tuning into my conversation with Edwina Van Gaal. To learn more about her work, visit her websites at perfectearthproject.org and 234birds.org. That's the number 234birds.org. Thanks for tuning in. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. I hope you'll listen, follow, rate, and review all of our episodes, which are available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts.